And in a moment, we're going to go live to the United Kingdom to talk with Lynn McTaggart about intention. You might remember a year ago, by the way, she conducted an experiment with you over Washington, D.C. to reduce crime. We should have the results tonight as well. And I do want to tell you there's a possibility that with some phone issues in the United Kingdom, we may not complete the entire interview with Lynn tonight. And if that is the case, we will go to open lines as well, and I'll give you those numbers as soon as I know that. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, one of our favorite guests, Lynn McTaggart, author, of course, of The Field, The Intention Experiment, The Bond, the new one, which we'll talk about, and we're going to talk about these intention experiments. Let's go live to the United Kingdom and check out this phone. Hey, Lynn, how are you?
Hey, George, how you doing? I
good.
Hope you can hear me.
I do, and actually it sounds pretty good right now. So far, so good.
And if we have a problem, my office is 7 minutes away. I can always drive over there over the break.
While I'm tap dancing. what are you doing? Have you always been in the United Kingdom when we talk?
I've been here half my life. I came over here to research a book years ago, and on the Kennedys when they were over in the UK, and Kathleen Kennedy, who married a Brit, and I ended up doing the same, George.
Well, okay, but when I chatted with you a year ago, I think you were in the States, weren't you?
No, I was over here. I was here.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I come to the States a lot, but no, I married a Brit. I've got two children over here, and we're here.
I did not know that. I did not know that at all. Well, good. See, you learn something every day.
Well, I always say I got lost. I came here for 3 months, and I stayed, 25 years.
Good for you. Lynn, a year ago, we all conducted an experiment, an intention experiment, trying to reduce crime over Washington, D.C., and you were going to come back and tell us the results. Do you have them by any chance yet?
I do. And it's really exciting because, one of the frustrating things about doing a peace intention experiment, George, is that you have to sit for months and just allow things to unfold because it's not going to mean very much if you look at a month afterward. And you also have to analyze what happened for a year before. So what we did was we wanted to wait for an entire year, a year before and a year afterward, to see a real long tail, to see the whole, trend. Mm-hmm. And then you have something a bit more meaningful. And the results are just extraordinary.
All right, let's go through some of them. And tell us the method. What did we use here? What was the method?
Okay, we analyzed, first of all, what was great about doing this intention experiment was, unlike the other ones I've done before, they've been in war-torn areas. We sent an intention to Sri Lanka in 2008 and 2011 for the 9/11 anniversary. We sent intention to two provinces in Afghanistan. Those are really hard places to get data out of. You can just imagine. I mean, with the one in Afghanistan, I had to call, everywhere and finally got NATO generals. This was easy because the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C. have a very, very careful record of every single crime in every single area. So if you recall, we sent intention. We focused on Capitol Hill, but we focused on also on some neighborhoods with higher crime. And they included particularly Ward 1, which has Columbia Heights, Adams Morgan, Mount Pleasant, and Shaw, those areas. But our real focus was on Ward 6, which is Capitol Hill. So my team, and I had several scientists working with me and an analyst who is a specialist in number crunching, look over the data for violent crime and property crime, because they've got everything. And by violent crime, they mean things like homicides and sex abuse and robbery with guns and assaults with dangerous weapons. And then for property crime, they mean burglary, theft, stealing cars, arson, that sort of thing. So, Washington, D.C., as we know, is a very high crime area in the States. So, looking over that, And this is an interesting thing, too, because we did a double experiment. We did an experiment with you, and I did an experiment with Gaiam TV, okay, where I repeated the experiment in September because I wanted to also see whether or not we had a blip. You know, did we have two little blips, or was it any bigger trend or whatever? So, first of all, both areas, Ward 1 and Ward 6, definitely had, and we looked from the year before to the year after this experiment in June, and that was June 6th. In Ward 6, Ward 1, the trend was the violence after June 6th was a bit more volatile, but definitely lower than the previous year of the same period. Now, remember, we just mentioned those areas, but this is where it really gets interesting. When we then looked at Capitol Hill for total violent crime, there was a 33% decrease.
That's huge.
Huge. I mean, and we were absolutely astonished. And then a clear sign of lower crime rates on both sides, with both areas, but particularly in Capitol Hill. And interestingly enough, that carried on just until May of this year, and then it bounced right up again. So, and it bounced up to the levels of 2011. So if you compare the whole thing right after your experiment, there was a complete and definite downward trend. And here's where it really gets interesting. Only in violent crime. Property crime stayed completely steady.
Well, and we concentrated only on violent crime.
On violence, absolutely. So, and here's another really interesting thing. Remember we were talking about, you know, trying to create peace on Capitol Hill. The very next day after our experiment, as you know, Nancy Pelosi, the minority speaker, and the current speaker of the House, John Boehner, are terrible, terrible enemies. And on that particular day, he went over and gave her an enormous hug and announced that it was her 25 years of anniversary. And he said, I speak for the House when I rise today and say to the gentle lady from California, congratulations, and gave her a big hug, which was photographed. So my scientists were really giggling about this one, saying, well, something must have gone on.
Let's talk about the intention then. And I'm wondering what the FBI would have said about that 33% decrease in violent crime. They probably are scratching their heads not knowing what had happened. let's look at intention itself. What do you think it is, Lynn? We all agree that it works, but what is it?
I think it is energetic light, to be honest. No one knows for certain, but we have to get away from the idea that we are solid, stable, and just chemicals and electrical things. You know, that's the way ordinary science describes us, as, you know, a lot of electrical signaling. But we're actually beings of energy and light. And we know this because when we look at quantum physics, we see that at our nethermost level and at the nethermost level of everything in quantum physics, we are vibrating packets of energy. And that's what subatomic particles are. They're not little billiard balls. They're little vibrating packets of energy, trading energy back and forth with themselves and with a background energy field. But we also know that we emit light. All living things emit tiny, tiny currents of light. And this light, this signaling, in a sense, gets sent back from other living things, and it is synchronicitous. There's, you know, when there's light going out, light comes back as though there is this invisible conversation. And there is a suggestion that when we send a thought is another kind of this light energy. And we know this from other measurements. Now, remember, we had Dr. Roger Nelson on our show last year on June 6th.
Right.
He participated too. Now, Roger Nelson runs a thing called the Global Consciousness Project, which has those random event generators going all the time. And they are, your listeners probably know what these are, but they are like electronic tosses of the coin. And normally they just have this output that's ongoing all the time that's random. And it's kind of random heads and random tails. And pretty much when it's running randomly, it has 50% heads and 50% tails all the time. Now, Roger analyzes it when there are moments of huge group intention and group activity. That's what he's been doing for years now.
He sees spikes, doesn't he?
He looks, finds these little spikes where the machines veer off their random course. And he analyzed just the 5-minute window of our experiment on June 6th and 7th and found that there was this spike. And he looked at it in September when we ran our other intention experiment, and exactly the same one did. And there was a significant alteration off this random course. And while he says, well, when you've got this little tiny type of experiment, you can't say anything definitive, you know, you have to repeat it many, many times to do so, it still is very interesting.
It's
and
nice.
He's run this with me every time we've done a peace intention experiment, and he's found that spike just in that little window of intention.
What do you do next if we assume that these experiments are working, that intention works? How do you top yourself?
I have been, last February, I spoke to a member of government of a third world country where I was, and they are very interested in doing an experiment to lower violence. There's a lot of drug trafficking, a lot of violence in this country, and they're very interested in doing an intention experiment. So that, to me, would top it if we go ahead.
Well, there's no question it works, but I've got to ask you this, Lynn. If you can use it for good, can it also be used for evil? Can you have the same kind of people with intent, but that they want to do evil things? Can that work?
Absolutely. I mean, and that is the frightening thought. If you think of Hitler, in a sense, had an amazing, coherent intention. I mean, he seduced an entire population to have the intention to take over the world. And, you know, he was highly successful for a while. I think the good thing is there are not too many people with that kind of ability to almost mass hypnotize a population. And good intention requires a kind of very ordered mind, you know, an ordered and very highly focused mind. And if you recall, during our intention experiment, I was trying to lead everybody listening on the call to a state of very focused attention on our target. Now, on our ordinary day-to-day living, people who are, you know, have evil intent usually don't have such an ordered mind. They can do it,
yeah.
Of course, it's possible. They can do, but it's not, you know, it's not that often. I think, you know, there is this kind of highly ordered mind in, you know, some of the big corporations, you know, who have less than good intent in some of the things they do in the world. And I think that is one thing that we have to worry about. I think the intention of certain large corporations is one of the most worrying things there is. So I guess intention doesn't have a morality. The answer to your question is intention can be used for good or bad.
So let's look at the things that have happened over the last year or so, like in the Middle East, the uprisings, you know, people wanting to throw their leaders out. Could that be because people are using intent to do that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it starts with an idea. You know, it starts that these kinds of revolutions start with an idea, and then people use their intention and their focus, and then that becomes almost like a snowball. So it is always a powerful, powerful element to shape reality and create reality.
Yeah, all that is true, no doubt. Now, you call your new work The Bond. Explain that.
Well, I was fascinated and, you know, concerned about what had gone on from 2008 and the whole, you know, economic worldwide meltdown and all the things going on. And I started wondering and asking myself a basic question. Was competition supposed to be inherent in the human experience? Were we meant to be this competitive with each other? Because I started thinking that the whole economic meltdown really had a lot to do with a kind of I win, you lose mentality, which is really the, I think, the engine of our society. You know, it's competition. Fierce competition is the engine of our educational model, our business model, our financial model, just about every kind of model that we live by. So the real question was, were we supposed to be this? And I looked through all sorts of science, from psychology and sociology to physics and biology, et cetera. And the overwhelming answer was no, because nature has designed us for connection, not competition, and that really in every aspect, from our subatomic particles to the way we try to connect with each other in our society, there is a bond. And I use the word bond. What I meant by that is a connection so profound and integral, it's hard to say where one thing ends and another thing begins. And I concluded that we were really, the reason we're in the mess we're in now is because we're essentially living against nature.
Well, you may be right about that. But, you know, when you look at the bond, and you want to move beyond intention now, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, because I found that what's also important is the extraordinary power of connection. When you actually move back into that state, the state that nature designed us for, which was connection, things start working a lot better in your life. Things start working a lot better for all of us, you know, collectively and individually. So what I've been looking at lately, really over the past year, is combining these ideas and using the power of intention and connection. And it's an extraordinarily potent force. And I've been trying it in big groups and in little groups.
What is the chief strength of the bond?
Well, I love what has been going on in little groups that I've been working with. And I'd like to call it the power of eight. I just did this by accident, George. I was trying to figure out how to show people what intention and connection looks like. And so I put people together in little groups in one of my workshops, groups of 8 to 12, and I asked them to pick somebody in the group with a healing challenge of some sort. And the group would all design an intention together, and they would all hold hands in a circle or put the person with the challenge in the center and all put their hands on that person, something like that, and all get into a meditative state and think the same intention for healing that person and visualize that person well, etc. We just did these little, you know, types of groups like that. And I was just astonished because the next day, you know, it would be a weekend workshop. People would come back and people with serious, serious health issues would be better. You know, they would... people with arthritis who couldn't walk very well with a bad knee or something would be walking much better. People, one woman who had an opacity of one in one eye could barely see. She was about 80% better.
Hold on, Lynn. We're going to hit this break. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, take a gander at our television show, Beyond Belief, if you would. You get 10 days free. You can also look at some incredible videos that are available to you, all kinds of special training and self-help programs, whole bunch of them. Again, 10 days free. Go to coasttocoastam.com, click hosts at the top of the show, and there's the link for the TV show. You'll also see it at our highlights reel tonight at coasttocoastam.com. It's called Beyond Belief, and we will be beyond belief in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Lynn Dick-Taggart with us. We'll take calls next hour. Lynn, as we were talking about intention for health, no question it works, doesn't it?
It definitely does, as I was talking about with my little groups. You know, the lame were walking, George. And I was just astonished by this, and I thought I'd discovered something really unique. But my husband, who was, you know, studying the ancient Essenes one day, turned to me and said, you know, they were using these healing intention circles. And so was Jesus, you know, before he was, you know, big Jesus, was using these healing intention circles. So all I've done is really stumbled onto an ancient healing practice.
Okay, so let us get into some of the other things that have been going on in terms of intention and rebuilding. How far can it go, then? I mean, at what point do you say enough is enough?
Enough is enough with intention. I mean, I think that we've got a lot of work to do right now. You know, there's so many things that aren't working right in our country, the U.S., in the world these days. And I think it's really powerful, the idea of us coming together with a single thought to do some rebuilding, which is a lot of the work that I've been doing over the past year. You know, I was a bit concerned last year with 2012 because there was a lot of talk about automatic evolution. You know, like we were going to just walk through this portal on December 2012 and everybody would have a new and raised consciousness. But, you know, I kept feeling, well, no, I think it's going to have to be something conscious that we do. We've got to really change the way we're doing things. And so I put together a very simple and free program because I felt people should have access to this. And I just have it on one of my websites. It's the Bond site. That's thebond.net. And, you know, it's all about how do you use this power of intention and connection to rebuild your neighborhood from the bottom up? Because, you know, to me, it was really apparent and is apparent that government isn't working, you know, and the people on each side of the aisle just cannot speak to each other anymore. And it's become so complicated and bureaucratic and corrupt that I felt that for people to really rebuild this country, it's got to happen neighborhood by neighborhood. And so I felt that I wanted to help people with a toolkit. So I'd been studying a lot about what kinds of tools, relationship tools and things like that, really help people to come together and how to use intention in a small group. And so that's really what I've been doing. I've got hundreds of groups now formed around the world who are, and thousands of people now interested in doing this, where they're just taking these tools and just using it.
You think connection is more powerful than intention. How come?
Well, I think with the whole idea of intent, we were never meant to be alone. And I think that our life has become one of such isolation. But when we look at the science, George, you see that belonging is probably more important to the human spirit than even eating. You know, that physically, connection and feeling like a sense of belonging is actually like a really potent drug. It protects us against heart disease. You know, half of people who get heart disease don't have any signs of high cholesterol and all those risk factors. They are simply lonely. And it protects us against all kinds of diseases like that, stroke, et cetera. And so I think it is like the best drug you'll ever take. And I've also seen what's really interesting. When they look at scientific studies of people doing something together with a common goal, you know, like building a barn, for instance, everybody's brainwaves start resonating in synchrony. So that powerful resonance is what really amplifies intention. So it's why I think group intention is so powerful and why we're seeing these effects on studies like this, like our peace intention experiment.
Well, when you wrote The Field, for example, and we were talking about this something that's in the universe and out there, it's connected to everything we've talked about, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, because once again, we have to stop thinking of ourselves as discrete things that end with the hair on our skin, because that's the model we've got of the universe now. But what we're really talking about is one giant energy field of which we're simply part. And so this is really what I'm talking about, is a connection, doing things in groups, is really about plugging into the source. It's about getting yourself to be part of that field again, really feeling the field.
Do you think the more are more powerful than the one?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, George, and we've looked at it. We've run 26 of these intention experiments now, and all but I think a few haven't worked, and mostly they were design problems. And I've done them in big, big groups like yours, 4 million people listening, and I've done them in groups of 100. And I've found that size doesn't seem to matter, at least as far as what we see. Mm-hmm. What matters is that there is a group of some sort, that there is more than one, you know, and also experience counts. It seems like the more people have practiced intention, practiced getting into a really focused mind state, and, you know, in my book, The Intention Experiment, I actually designed a program that was, I spoke to a lot of intention masters, master healers, Buddhist monks, you know, those kinds of people, and tried to distill from all of their practices a common thread. You know, what do they all do in common? And I put that together, distilled that into a little program. And when people learn how to focus their mind and send it out, and it's heart-centered and all those kinds of things, it works better. So I think experience counts, not size.
I think you're right. I think if you have one powerful individual who really understands this, who really knows how to tap into it, he could be, she could be, just as effective as 3 million people together.
Yeah. And what I have found, though, is that's so interesting, is that something seems to supercharge it when it's a group, even when it's a group of eight.
And when if it's, you know, this supercharge, whatever it is, what could it be, the God figure?
Well, I think it's that feeling of connection, of belonging. And when people talk, and I think it's a feeling of tapping in. I mean, I've watched these groups over 6-7 years, and in workshops I do and things like that, and I find that, you know, these are people creating groups with total strangers, and yet they feel so connected. There's tears, there's sharing, there's common visualizations. They'll report having common visualizations. And also, after these big intention experiments we've done online, I've surveyed people. You know, I survey the participants and ask them, okay, what's happened to you in these couple of months afterward? You know, I usually survey people a few months afterward. Mm-hmm. And people report, first of all, feeling this incredible, palpable sense of oneness when they've been part of this giant experiment, where they actually feel it. Remember, these are people who are, you know, listening on their radio or in front of a computer screen. That's the way we've run most of them, where they've had to come online somehow and, you know, and connect into this intention experiment. And they report feeling this sense of oneness. I've run this over teleseminars. They talk about the same feeling, and it seems to change them. They feel closer to everyone with whom they come into contact. So I think it is this powerful sense of really experiencing what connection is. Because, you know, we don't know what this is anymore. We're so isolated, particularly us in America.
Oh, we are. There's no doubt about it. People are sensing, Lynn, something impending, something big. Can they alter that or not?
Yeah. I think you definitely can. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think the future is laid out as a determined, you know, finality. I think that there is always the future is only a potential, and that we and our intention are crucial, critical, to what goes on. And I think what people are all sensing is we've ended, we've come to the end of a certain kind of way of living, you know. And I don't mean the end of prosperity forever. I mean the end of the I win, you lose mentality, because that's what's governed the way we've lived for several hundred years. It's really been the whole root of our industrialized capitalistic world. And I'm not saying the end of capitalism either, but I think that corporations and individuals are all realizing this old way doesn't work anymore. We have to be much more conscious and connected in the way we're doing business and the way we're being with each other. So I think that's what we're sensing. We're sensing the end of this, the end of something.
Why does it work? Not how, but why does it work?
Why does connection work?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it works because nature's designed every aspect of us to feel connected, to be part of something bigger. You know, even a subatomic particle doesn't exist on its own. It's part of a giant energy field. It is constantly trading information with other subatomic particles. So it's like a shapeshifter. It doesn't have any finite beginning or ending. And when you start scaling up and you start looking at the way biology has created us, we're like that too. You know, we have mirror neurons. So when somebody is in front of us, what they do, any movement they do, any emotion they have, the very same neurons fire in us as if we were having that emotion. You know, nature's designed us to feel into, to merge with other people at every moment. We are constantly copying other people. You know, emotion is contagious. Movement's contagious. We're constantly copying each other in just about every way. And so everything we do has been designed to connect. And yet we've created a society where everybody is so isolated and more isolated and pitted against each other to survive. Of course we're sick. Of course it's not working. It's against nature.
Is this going to get better for most people or worse?
That's a really good question. I think it depends on us. You know, I think it could get a lot worse if we allow it to, or we can start changing. And that's really what my book, The Bond, is all about. It's all about trying to provide people with the toolkit of change and trying to empower people to understand that, you know, what I was really interested in was looking at how many people are required to really make changes. And scientists were looking at, they've looked at through, you know, a lot of modeling and game theory, what happens in a culture of greed when things are starting to fall apart and individuals are just taking what they can get for themselves. And they found that actually all it takes is one or two people wedded to fairness in that little culture to turn the whole game around. I mean, when they've done this in game theory, et cetera. And that's really interesting. And that's what got me the idea of, you know, just helping people with a toolkit, with the Bond handbook, with the book, The Bond, to take some tools about changing the way they relate to people using the power of groups, mainly using the power of small groups in their neighborhood or their office or whatever, to turn that culture around. And it doesn't take much. It takes somebody to do something, to remind everybody of it.
Do you think small groups are critical?
Yes, I think small groups are absolutely critical. I think they are going to be the agent of change, not the government. I think the government's broken. I think we have to all recognize that. It's almost beyond repair, and it'll only respond to the will of the people doing something different. And I think, you know, the power of small groups is such that they can make local changes, and those local changes will start having impacts and become contagious with other groups until the government will turn around and start responding. I think the other thing that's really important with small groups is that they can start movements over subversive media like the internet. And those movements can so quickly go viral. I mean, for instance, a really good movement is deciding if we want to affect some change is consumer boycott. It's the most powerful thing we can do if we want to stop a corporation from doing something. And that can start, and always has started, with tiny groups.
And then it grows, doesn't it?
It grows, and we're at a really wonderful point because, just like the Arab Spring, which you talked about before, we have this wonderful subversive instrument called the Internet. They can't get to that because, you know, things can go viral and go out of the control of the controlled media, the normal media, very, very quickly, and, you know, and go viral. And there is no way of stopping that. And that can start, and always has started, with a small group.
I think going viral, the social networking, is probably one of the most fascinating phenomena I have ever witnessed, Lynn.
Oh, me too. And I mean, I think it's such an exciting time for media too, because it's as media, as the traditional media, you know, the newspapers, et cetera, get more and more controlled by big corporations. I mean, we're finding that. Remember, I'm a journalist by training, and I, you know, have a magazine, and I have a very subversive magazine, health magazine. And I've found it's really interesting because I've seen the conventional media. I've been doing this health publication, What Doctors Don't Tell You, for 23 years now. And when we started, there was a lot in the newspaper about alternative health, and there was a genuine debate. You know, if there was something that came up, a new drug, a new vaccine, there was a good debate. I'd usually be wheeled on. I'm talking about over here in the UK. I'd right. usually be wheeled on to debate some doctor about it. Now there's no debate. The conventional media is completely taken over by corporations. And so that's why so that is also big top-down control. And this is another reason why I think it's very important for small groups, local groups, to start and to create, you know, to create the changes they need making in their communities, in their workplaces, rather than waiting for, you know, these big corporations, which are more and larger conglomerates,
and they're slower too. And I'll tell you, one of the things social media seems to be doing, I'm in St. Louis for another week. The pride of St. Louis in terms of a newspaper was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It mm-hmm. used to be a thick newspaper, Lynn. Now it's like paper thin, the entire newspaper. I mean, it's changed. Social networking has changed these things dramatically.
I know. And it's, you know, and that is a sad thing. I mean, I look at that, even the New York Times is a tiny little shadow of what it was. On the other hand, as those newspapers are controlled more and more by the big corporations, it's possibly a good thing that people are getting their information from other means. And that's another way of signaling to the corporations. And I think, you know, corporations understand this now, George, because it's very interesting. I've been called to do some speaking in front of big business about the bond. I'm doing something in Malaysia in front of business leaders in December.
Wow.
And I'm also working with some people in business to bring some of these bond principles to banks over here, because they realize they have such a tarnished image, and their ways of working don't work anymore.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Lynn, when we come back, plus a whole hour of phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.